Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Lisnick, Behind the Curtain. It's my chance to step away from the world of politics and law you watch me cover on television every day into the world of true passion, the world of theater and arts. And, you know, my guest in this show is actually someone who bridges that line a little bit because he actually is passionate about politics and social issues. And I know that because it just reads through in his new autobiography called Effective Memories, How Chance and the Theater Saved My Life. It might have saved my life too, but Lawrence Luckinbill joins me. Larry, I've been wanting to do this for so long. I've read your book from cover to cover. I've written 15 books. I can't write a book this long. Congratulations.
Oh, yes, yes. We just had a friend here who I just signed the book for him, and he said, couldn't you have made it shorter?
Well, here's the truth. So much to talk to you about. But when I first read the title, Effective Memories, my mind went right to sort of classical training of Stanislavski. And exactly. And I'm not off base there because this there is a lot of traditional classic theater training weaved in here.
Yes, yes. And it's actually the base of all theater. It's the base of all the process of someone trying to get into the skin and our soul of someone else and reproduce that in a form which makes a difference to the world somehow.
The truth is, I felt like there was more than one book here. And I know, and you shared with me in our emails, another book is coming, though that yes. book will focus in on parts of your life. We'll talk about it, but you know that you've had. But I actually saw another book. I guess it has to be a third book. And that is, I'm seeing a book in which from this one, I picked up so many themes of life, of relationships, of finding ourselves that yes. I feel like somewhere there's what the industry would call a self-help book, one to help others find themselves. Does that make off
base? No. People talk about this because they're very surprised. Once you get down to being really honest about your life, and it wasn't easy, you find out that there are so many people who can agree with some of the things that you revealed about yourself because they're going through the same things. And so, yes, I sort of abhor the idea of self-help only because it's been so commercialized, I guess. And yet, I have many, many young friends who I talk to because they come to me to talk about what to do. And not least of it, I have 5 children who are all adult children. And yet they have many, many problems that I did not have, nor maybe you. When we were growing up, we were it was an older culture, and it was still in full belief of the Constitution and all kinds of things. And I know my father was a salesman in the Depression when I was born. He was a $1 a day guy and commission. And there were deals struck only with a handshake, and they were adhered to. And I like that. And my father was an honest man. He had lots of faults. He was an alcoholic, but he was a straightforward stand-up guy in the rest of his life, you know?
You put all this out. I mean, and even there, you're giving us some details. This is your life, the decisions, the mistakes, the good, the bad. I found it incredibly raw, incredibly honest. I mean, you said that, you know, a lot of celebrities, and you live in the world of theater, a lot of celebrities would have either denied some of the things you put in the book, certainly not disclosed them. And I know that so much of this comes from, and you open the book by telling us how your daughter, Kate, would every night, "Dad, tell us a story. Tell me a story." When this got written, I'm sort of curious, and maybe one day we'll do an interview with Kate and Lucy and others. Did they read this and go, "Well, I didn't know that stuff, Dad. This was really raw and honest." Or did they know all of this?
We had one friend, and there's so many revelations in the book about me personally. And all kinds of things. And it was painful to write, but you know, I found out who I was in the writing, but this one guy read the book, the whole book. He's a theatrical friend. And he said, he came down to say, boy, there's some things in that book, boy, that I never ever thought about Larry. And he said, like, he voted for George Bush. That was the only thing but I think he was playing.
Everything else made sense.
Yeah. Yes, I did vote for Bush one time. Because you know why? I bought the craziness that the democracy would just fall like a gentle rain from heaven in Iraq as we marched in.
And again, I feel like I want to jump now because you're so well known for one-man plays you've done on LBJ and others, and I know those influenced you, but I'm not ready to go there yet. So let us talk a little bit about, you said you grew up in a dysfunctional family, as you said, in Arkansas, with all due respect, not a place I care to move to. But no. I think the critical, I don't know, maybe Lucy would have gone there with you. I don't know. But I think the critical also would be that, You had no models. You stayed there. Your future would have gone nowhere.
No, that's true.
Is what I meant to say.
I said I had no heroic models, which was what a young man needs. A young kid with a dream that has come upon him to have something finer than what he can see, and something higher actually in the universe. I looked for those models, and of course, my first one was Captain Marvel, and that was, you know, let's leave the politics totally out of it. And as I gradually, I grew into understanding that my models may not have been heroic, but they were mentors who touched me at a time I needed a touch on my shoulder to go this way and not that. And I was a kid that was so hungry for peace and beauty in the Ozarks, where it was there to be seen and had, except that the culture was so lacking in anything cultural that we would call cultural now, except for the music.
Yeah,
people would gather on their porches at night and play, and that was fabulous.
And that would be nice. That little Andy Griffith in there, I suppose, in the way that they live. When I first got the book, and I, you know, just started to thumb through it before I was going to sit down and read it, I was struck by the fact that it's essentially structured as a script. I mean, literally. And I know you took 10 years to write this, and again, triggered by your daughter Kay's request for stories every night.
Yes.
I did wonder. I mean, you don't do things not deliberately. So the fact that you structured it as a script struck me, again, going deeper maybe than I should, but is this about an actor speaks in script, or was this about looking at your life and realizing that in many ways you've lived something that perhaps was scripted?
No, it's not that. It's the first, the former. I have given the script to one person.
By the way, when I said scripted, I mean, you know, meant to be.
Meant to be taken that way. It ought to be read in scenes because I was lived in scenes. I discovered somewhere along the line, actually it was in, no, it wasn't in Chicago. It was in Oakland, that I discovered that I was watching a bunch of Latino kids negotiate with some white kids in a park in Oakland for a basketball. And one of them had a switch knife. And I'm just watching this. I'm much bigger than these kids, and I wasn't afraid. And I was just wallpaper watching this. And I heard it all. They negotiated a truce. And as I walked away, I was not in the theater. I was not supposed to be in the theater. I was supposed to be a doctor. And I was struggling with that. And I knew nothing about the theater at that point. But I walked away thinking, that's a perfect movie scene. I should write that down. And when those kind of thoughts come to you, when you're a doctor, you it depends what kind of doctor you are. You better not be operating on a heart or something when you're drifting away, you know, like that.
Well, you say doctor, by the way. There's a reason you say that, was because there was a hope that, well, today I might be talking to Dr. Luckenbill about maybe a necessary appendix surgery.
Yeah, I'll see you now, sir. And tell me, Paul, what's hurting?
Everything.
I can agree
yeah,
with that.
Yeah, you hit that age when it's all hurting.
Well, I would have had a good bedside manner, but I think I should get a Nobel Prize for not becoming a doctor for all the lives I've saved.
I have to tell you that Wanda Sykes, I saw her a couple of weeks ago, and she made the point. She goes, you know, people are always saying, how did you sleep? How do you sleep? And I don't understand what that ever meant. She said, then I turned 60 and I realized, now I know why you asked me the question, how did you sleep? Because I can't get to sleep.
Yes. Yeah, well, there's gummies.
I love it. So you take the road to theater. Again, this could be a five-hour conversation, but thank you for letting me sort of just guide this. I do want to take a moment to do...
It will be. We'll just continue it.
We'll do. If nobody's watching, they're not watching. No, I want to talk about, you know, a lot of people, some do believe in love at first sight, some don't. You had been married. It was perhaps a troubled marriage. You disclose all of that in the book. Your first wife, also an actress. But then you get to this story about being in, I think it was Ted Hook's Backstage, essentially being introduced to somebody where you now came to believe in love at first sight. And I'm bringing her up now because, first of all, and the phrase gets used, but I love Lucy and you love Lucy. And we are just a couple of days away, not just from my birthday, but from your 45th anniversary. So mazel tov on that.
Yes. Yes. Oh, 45 years.
But when you met, neither of you thought you were each other's type.
Yeah, we were sitting in that restaurant. It was Ted Hook's Backstage in 46th Street. In the theater district, and he was an innkeeper, and he had the habit of, if you came in three times, the third time your name was on a small lamp that was on the table, the little sort of decorative lamp, and we met there to have a meal, and we were friends, and we'd been sort of moving around each other in a very unusual configuration. It wasn't about sex. It was about friendship. And
you're also older than her. At that time, you were 48. So you were 45. She was 28.
Yeah, that's correct. But I'm younger now.
Right. Exactly. So am I.
No, but anyway, we sat down at this place and both our names were on the lamp shade. And we're looking at that, and you know, I said, I've been thinking I'm not your type. And she said, I've been thinking I'm not your type. And it Israeli-Palestinian stymie. but that was not meant that way somehow. Because after that, I said, she complained about the Twinkies that she was dealing with. They were never called back, and you know, that kind of young person.
You didn't mean the dessert you're talking about.
No, not the Twinkies. No, not real Twinkies, but I don't know.
The young folks, I get it.
Yes, yeah. Now the young men who don't call back. And I said, I think you want to be courted. And she said, what? And then she thought, and she said, yes. And so then the next day, I did not call her back. I ordered every flower in the florist's room and sent it to her in the dressing room of her theater. And I put a card on it, and all I said on it was courting. And that, the world turned upside down. For real.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was a young woman who was deep beyond her years and hungry beyond her years for a real life. And By real life, I mean, it's almost exactly like what my daughter says these days. When we sent her to the University of Miami for theater, and she said to us on the first visit back in Miami, she said, "Mom, Dad, what I really want is a normal college experience." Because they were driving them insane with the theatrical, the urge to learn, the urge to teach. And she wanted to go to football games and go to the beach once in a while. And they just didn't do that in the theater department. They rehearsed every weekend, just like we do when we work in the theater, which is 8 shows a week. You don't have a holiday off. You have to work holidays because that's when people go to the theater.
Right.
And so, and Lucy wanted that too. She wanted some normalcy in her life because, of course, her life had been lived in flashbulb light. And she wanted.
By the way, there may be somebody who's watching who doesn't know that your wife, Lucy Arnaz Luckinbill, is the daughter of Desi and Lucy. So that's the scope.
Do you know their last names? Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball.
And Lucille Ball. That's right.
That's right. Yeah. So this theatrical thing that had gripped her all her life was something that I actively worked against in myself, even though I was so obsessed with becoming a good actor that it really filled my entire brain at that time. My brain was smaller, or maybe it was bigger. But all I thought about was, I want to be the best actor in the world.
But it's also interesting, I'm going to vary a little bit, because it's not as though you were born and said, I'm going to be an actor. I mean, your mom wanted medical school for you. You did work for the State Department, and I live in the world of politics and law. And so as I'm reading about your work in Africa and Italy, which I know is in another book to come,
It
still intrigued me. But there was nothing that could pull you away from, as you wrote, $5 in your pocket and the Great White Way.
Yes, I always returned. A lot of things were dangled in front of me, like the first anchorship of CNN when they decided to do 24/7. And the money, of course, is fantastic. And the issue of what are you going to do with the news? I said, I want to stand on a rooftop in Nairobi with a safari jacket on, reporting about the bombs that are falling all around me, and I want to be the manager of the news, and they said that's possible. This was when they were only doing 3 days, but I had just gotten divorced.
Just starting out, it would have been the first.
I had my kids to take care of, and so I turned it down, and I also turned it down for a job in New York, a theatrical job that paid zero. So
that's
I was all I went back to the weirdos.
I love it. Yeah, and that's where you came up. Listen, when I was in school, my parents, well, they wanted me to become also potentially a doctor, but I can't stand the sight of blood. I did become a lawyer, but found a way to work it into the arts. So now I play lawyer on TV and you know, which is great.
Not an entertainment lawyer. A lawyer.
No. No. We might also have, this isn't clear in your book, so I get to talk to you and find out whether we have another mutual connection. Because you were cast by the great, legendary Joe Papp.
Yes.
As Romeo.
Yes.
And that doesn't have a happy ending to the story, but the reason I'm bringing, because you got fired, but the reason I'm bringing that up is that as you wrote it, you were fired by somebody who you said was a nice, kind lady.
Yes.
I interviewed not all that long ago, Gail Papp, who was Joe Papp's wife, about her autobiography. And I wondered, is that who did that?
No, it was.
Oh.
It was director Stuart Vaughn's wife. Stuart Vaughn had a repertory company in New Orleans. It was quite successful. And his wife was working for Joe as an amanuensis. And she was the one that got all the crap to do. And one of them was fire people, I guess. And after 3 days of rehearsing, and after, I have to say, 3 days of rigorous auditions,
yeah,
he just changed his mind. And boom, boom, I'm out. And I walked out of there feeling like a guy with toilet paper stuck in the bottom of his shoe when he walks out of the restroom, you know. It was devastating. But I was working as a host in a downtown steakhouse in New York, and I went right back to my job the same moment. Right, I jumped in the subway and went back downtown, and the owner was there, and he gave me the traditional slap on the face. He said, "You good kid, take over." You know, he got the job back.
I love
it. Saved my ass, you know.
Happy ending. So, but did you know Gail Papp? You must have known Gail Papp at some point in there, maybe before they were married. No, with regard to work.
Before whom? Oh, Joe.
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And I go after, too, because he hired me again to do a Thomas Babe play called A Prayer for My Daughter with Jeff DeMunn and George Zundas and some other people. There were, and Alan Rosenberg, who used to run the SAG. But Alan was a young kid, and he and I were handcuffed together because I was his pimp, a street pimp.
Oh, God.
And we were the horror guys, and the other two guys were the cops. And it was a struggle between, it was an attitude struggle. And Joe came up to me again, in the rehearsals, and he said, "You know, I think, can I tell you something? You're not doing this right." And I said, "No, why is that, Joe?" He said, "Because you need to be more humiliated." Well, to an actor, that is not a direction.
No, but you did get advice from Uta Hagen, who you studied with, again, just such a classic name.
Yes.
He said to you, "Larry, you have the technique. Now go find yourself." When exactly. I read that in the book, this is one of the things that I went, you need to write another book, because there's just such strong messages in that.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. So you think I have more to say about that?
I thought you were saying something to me. It's the kind of stuff that I kept pulling, and I've got more, kind of stuff that I kept pulling out. So for the moment, Uta Hagen, you have the technique. Now find yourself. Imagine every actor needing to hear that.
Yes. All it is be there, be here now. Whenever you walk out on the stage, don't stop thinking about you. Be here with the person that you are now existing in. And that's what effective memories is. Effective memories are your own personal memories of emotional stuff that you're dealing with or you're not, but you know is there. And you find a character that you've got to play, and no matter what that character is, there's got to be some analog in your own feelings. So you have, if you find that, you can use it to put real emotion that belongs to you into the character that you're portraying.
There was an actor who influenced you, and I'm going to tell you a story you might not know, and then we'll say who the actor is. Yeah. But there were a group of comedians, insult comedians, they would get together and they'd have parties and such. And this particular actor would be there and nobody would sort of give him a hassle. And when somebody asked him, like, "Why are you staying here?" he said, "I'm waiting for somebody to insult me." And that actor was Charles Laughton.
Yes.
And you saw him in a really different setting, but very,
very interesting. Charles Laughton was a deep river, baby. Oh, he was so deep. He had so much going on. By the way, one of the actors in Chicago that I loved, I don't know if he's still around, I hope he is, Mike Nussbaum.
He just passed away a few months ago.
That's what I thought.
At the age of, I think, 96. And he was still, he had another script. He was ready to do another play.
Of course. That's Mike. And I just have to say, for the record, in Chicago, I adored Mike Nussbaum. I worked with him in a movie that was made for PBS about an alcoholic doctor, and I played the doctor, and he played my partner. And he's the one who called me in and said, I know what's going on. You have to change. And I went, yeah, you know, because I didn't think I needed to.
To call Mike a legend is just not doing enough to the word legend, because this guy, yes, your love for him and Chicago's love for him was talented.
He is the Chicago guy, because he was tough, he was outspoken, but he was absolutely community organized and community forward.
Yeah,
and he was a pal, a buddy to everybody.
I wish he was still here. I would relate those regards.